views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Bronze Call.
And he increases the number of clocks by exactly one.
Everybody's coming home for lunch these days. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
Oh, I love this song. Every time I hear it, I start changing the words to it. So take the Republicans bowling.
Nice. So I wonder, in America, skinheads don't necessarily mean the same thing, right? I mean, at least in the 90s, sort of, I remember there were like ska skinheads. I even saw a black skinhead in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. I remember where. Because as somebody who knew the skinheads from Europe, in like the 80s,
he was brave. Like,
no black skinheads. Nope. No, not really.
He was really brave.
It's like being a black Klansman a little bit, you know? I mean, in European context, shall we say. So it's odd. But yeah, I know. So I know that America skinheads became a bit of a, like, you know, music, fashion, sure, without the national, the new Nazi politics. Or at least they're out there. I'm not sure. No experts. So I'm sorry if I'm offending both the black skinheads and the neo-Nazi skinhead. Actually, I'm not sorry if I'm offending you latter ones. Well, you know, again, because I'm, depends on the context, frankly.
Sometimes,
if I have a neo-Nazi in my class, then I respect them. You know, if you say, I listen quietly, I engage, I discuss, I can hear anything, you know, I know how to bite the inside of my mouth on the job. I am loving.
You're always loving. You're really good at that.
And you've seen me sometimes, like, you know, you're like, I even know, some students like you know, you'd like swing, whenever somebody would say something really like, and you know, you're like, right away looking at me and then what's he gonna say? Let's see how you're getting out of that one. But no, I actually, you know, I think I have a good record and I'm doing it because I believe in it. I mean, I really think, especially when I'm as a teacher. Sometimes I don't have that kind of patience when I'm civilian. You know, that could be a very different reaction all of a sudden. Yeah.
That's on your time.
On my time, right. And, you know, because that's professional, right? I mean, when I'm a teacher, it's my job to if they're not introducing controversial ideas, I'll do it for them. Somebody needs to introduce
Somebody's
them,
gotta
right?
Do it.
To look at them, to place, to discuss, you know, how good or evil are they, how smart or stupid are they, or some combination thereof, and what are the criteria we're judging by? Are we sure we're judging by the same criteria? Because otherwise this is like comparing apples and oranges, ta la la. You know, hey, philosophy is a very analytical thing. People think philosophy is like, leaning back and thinking about stuff,
right.
And people
after
forget
a couple
that
cocktails.
Logic was invented to deal with ethics. Ethics was analytical before math came to the Western world, at least. Yeah, I know. I'm sure in India and China, people have already been doing calculus for 3,000 years. I'm exaggerating, actually, but
that's
about 1,000.
Yeah.
Difference in time. Well, not calculus. Still though, it's something that I like to point out because people think that ethics is some kind of touchy-feely. No, there's a reason why it evolved, you know. We wouldn't be human had it not, or we'd be extinct already, or whatever. So where are we? Oh, yeah, former Prime Minister. Well, isn't it remarkable? It really doesn't happen often. But thanks to you, it just happened. I am going to say something good about my old country.
There you go.
It doesn't happen often. Well, it's nice to know that despite the acute similarities between the two countries that makes them kind of stuck in this unhappy, you know, bad for both sides marriage, in a sense, a very dysfunctional one, they jailed a crook. We've abandoned doing this.
I know.
Completely. You know, FBI has a file. Chief Justice Holder calls them up and say, don't prosecute. These are bankers.
Right. These are friends.
Yeah. You know, but we have evidence. They broke the law. We have evidence, you know. The too big to jail. You know?
That's a good one.
He has a good argument. He has a very articulate argument about it, you know, and the president buys into it too. Oh, mm-hmm. You know, they're too powerful because it's a corollary, of course, to the more famous too big to fail. So we funneled in immediately $800 billion. Yes, I know they tell you that they paid it back. Yes, they did pay up the cash allowance. What they fail to mention that they don't have never and cannot even begin to pay back the $6 to $9 trillion. That's mm-hmm. with a T, people. Yeah. That's $1,000 billion. Yeah. Which was funneled to them under other guises. Right. And again, in the Reagan years, when a tiny like case study of a similar, bubble exploded in the savings and loan scandal. And I think it's Bill Black, who's the forensic economist who wrote this really cool book, called The Best Way to Rob a Bank is to Own It. Which is a nice name.
Yeah. That's
and he was already, he actually worked. I mean, he's kind of a lefty, but he actually worked in the Reagan administration. Today he's a lefty, at least. So he actually does really exactly know. Of course, it was a much smaller scale. If somebody's like going, what is he talking about? Maybe you remember this came up last in 2008 campaign because John McCain actually found himself back in those days in an uncomfortable position
yes.
of being really close to one of the chief people that all of a sudden he's like the best friend
the
is in
five.
Orange jumpsuits on television.
The Kid in Five. Yeah. Yep. I remember that.
So, and frankly, again, I mean, this is not, I mean, so I could, John McCain, see, busted, whoa, you know, it happened to be busted. But again, back then, what did Ronald Reagan, famous Marxist, right? I mean, somebody needs to make like a Che Guevara t-shirt, but Ronald Reagan.
Ronald Reagan.
You know, we really should go into merchandise.
I know.
Seriously though, it's easy today. We really should. But anyway, so he nationalized the banks.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, of course. But it wasn't socialistic. Back then, if some kind of, let's say maybe, I don't know, I suppose because he was very popular and powerful leader of the Republican Party in many ways, but let's assume there would be some like a kind of proto-Tea Party yelling in the back, what do you mean nationalizing? What is this? Communism? What is going on? Blah, 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 blah. Then Ronald Reagan would say, what the hell are you talking about? Truly in his soft, kind of sexy voice. What are you talking about? I'm just, you know, in police investigation. Do you hear people like, there was a murder in this house, you know, the police, CSI is coming in to investigate. Oh, what is this? The government has taken over my house. It's nationalizing my living room. I mean, give me a break, right? I mean, give me a break. Mm-hmm. And of course, then that meant that independent accountants could look into banks, see what's solvable, what isn't, what needs to be funded, what needs to be scraped, who needs to go to jail. You know, it's my favorite metaphor when it comes to intellectual things, right? It's a nasty, ugly, shiny, whitehead pimple. And you need to pop it. It's nasty, but it needs popping, you know? A little alcohol afterwards wouldn't hurt, you know, to disinfect it too. One thing you certainly don't want to do is to cover it up. Right? It's a perfect metaphor.
Right,
one,
no,
it's really ugly, so it's perfect in that way. And secondly, it tells the story. So again, in the Reagan years, some process was followed. Rule of law. Rule of law. It's a really basic necessity. That too. You know what? Rule of law is wonderful in terms of human rights and in terms of opportunity, right? Everybody's equal under the law. I mean, it never obtained, right? It's just how close you come to even the neighborhood of that.
Right.
Nobody's perfect. But, you know, you have some kind of direction, trend, positive trend, not negative trend. But it's needed not because it's the right thing. Sorry. It is the right thing to do. Yes, it is needed. I agree. But it, much of the power that made it actually advance was powerful people needing the stability that it provides, especially for commercial activity, right? So already Rome, Julius Caesar wrote, he was a kind of a progressive socialist too. That's why they killed him. Well, you can't say socialist in the context of Roman Empire maybe, but he was a populist. A word that's come back, right? last we heard of it was a while. So yeah, he was kind of concerned with the plight and the problems of the poorer Romans. So, and that was always a split, by the way, in Rome, and that's a whole other topic. I need to bring an expert on it because I'm an avid amateur, but no more. I'll look for one. So, and later, and in the French Revolution, and maybe American Revolution, the Constitution, I mean, all of that stuff, the idea being that, before the Glorious Revolution in Britain, and before the changes of the 17th century, late 17th century, and all that, you know, you could do a business deal, right? And you're doing a business deal with somebody of a higher class than you. Maybe you're just a bourgeois, you know, you're just a non-noble, right, of the city, the people who, you know, who made the market system work and the industrialization, all that, who made it happen. And you're doing deal business with a marquis, yeah? And he doesn't want to pay you. What are you going to do? If you complain, he might actually run you through with a sword, kill you, clean it on his silk breeches, and move ahead. What a wonderful... Can you imagine if, you know, whenever somebody, you owe somebody money, you can just, no?
Blow him off.
Kill
yeah.
him?
Mm-hmm. Or kill him, yeah.
As Mel Brooks said in The History of the World, it's good to be the king. That's a great movie. I should see it again. It's a funny movie. Yeah, you know, so the rule of law is not just about the right way to run a society, the just way, all important concerns, but it's also the necessary way for a market-driven economy to function.
Right.
So people don't think about that. It's not about, oh, when you say, you know, arrest those people. I mean, they did, like, there's fraud, criminal fraud. Certainly bar them from ever working in this field. Don't give them a raise to... because they're so talented. The only talent that they showed was to get away with murder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the campaign election a little bit. What are we judging our economic, you know, our the most sophisticated financial people, you know? Why aren't we teaching in every course in economics from high school to graduate school the long, long tenure of Alan Greenspan in the head of the Fed? He was called Maestro. That was his nickname.
Right, right.
Genius. Everybody was like a bank, you know, an economist with the status of like, you know, a Miley Cyrus or something. The problem is that much less talented and qualified for anything. He messed up profoundly in ways that you cannot mess up more in the execution, in the assumption, in the underlying model. Utterly incompetent.
But
nothing personal, by the way. Again, nothing personal, Alan. You know?
Yeah.
But the Greenspan Fed was a catastrophe.
But the ones that really messed up were all these presidents on both sides who kept them there.
Well,
I mean, if that says anything about the way our government runs, it's kind of like it doesn't matter which party because Greenspan had both.
Well, it matters,
and
Democrats. It matters who you're accounted for. Now, I remember yesterday, everything was, Stalin, Joseph Stalin, the horrific dictator of Soviet Russia. I mean, well, at least after the war. I gotta respect him during the war because, you know, he did about 80% of the beating of the Nazis, just rough number in terms of, you know, how much in military engagement. We tend to forget that the Russians had already started pushing the Nazis back towards Berlin when any other troops joined in.
Well, that's of course, like most of the history that's being
fought
here.
There was financial and military equipment support. I mean, we were good friends back then. It's pre-Cold War, you know. Though, yeah, that's another story as we face a second Cold War. Or not face, we're in it already. Well in it. Maybe a much worse one. But anyway, where the hell was I? I don't know. Alan Greenspan was terrible. Well, we should know that. Oh yeah, accountability, right? So Stalin said back in the day that it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the votes. So,
interesting.
Alright, that's kind of nice sense, dark sense of humor here. But you could, you know, just electoral fraud, and we've had that significantly, most notably in the year 2000. That's another thing that should be kind of a big scandal in America. You know, it's bigger than Watergate. You know, here I am. Now I'm defending Nixon. I know. I mean,
right.
Like, it's topsy-turvy, upside-down world, right? Richard Nixon, the last liberal president, right?
Tricky Dicky.
The last liberal president, yes. Again, in terms of policies, right?
Right.
Crook perhaps, but, you know, Environmental Protection Agency, Clean Air Act, you know, frankly, you know, and honestly, you know, by today's standards, Boy Scout.
Absolutely, more like a Cub Scout. I mean, I'm completely appalled of the way our politicians behave nowadays.
But the demonstrated mass electoral fraud of 2000, the speculated significant data anomalies, but not as bad 2004,
mm-hmm.
2008. You know, we don't really even know much about 2012. Oh, I don't know much about 2012. So yeah, there have been things like that. And it's not like poor people and immigrants without IDs. It is organized under the great electoral genius of the evil emperor, Karl Rove. The Republicans did it. Again, I don't like Democrats either, but this is the fact. Republicans are at least better at electoral fraud than the Democrats.
You know what Justice Scalia said when it came down to that? He said in an interview, he was questioned about it, you know, in retrospect about the elections and all that. And, you know, what do you reply to, these people and all that? And he says, get over it.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that has to kind
of... get over it is really, I know, but everybody says get over it now. Right? It's the new thing, right? It's the inspirational poster. Everybody's over it.
Yeah.
I am so angry. Every time you do not tell me to get over anything, you know? I mean, of course, black people are the ones who have been pointing it out most vocally recently.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are being told to get over it.
Right, exactly.
And one thing that I, you know, pull the only little puny race card that I have, but I got it, so I'll put it on the table, you know? I mean, I'd like to think what would happen when people start telling Jews to get over it? I don't think that would go down very well.
Exactly.
I don't see the same people telling blacks to get over it, telling Jews to get over it. Now, okay, let's be cool about it. I guess if we're talking Holocaust here, it's more recent.
Right.
To a point, because, I don't know, for the parents of the many, many, and I'm not just talking about the couple of handfuls of famous people, you know, murdered by the police in recent years, but that's been going on
for quite some time. Yeah,
most people don't learn in their history courses how you know, the mass lynchings that were like a part of a Sunday afternoon after church activity all over the South, and not even the South, the North too, in the generation of you know, our parents. And maybe, you know, like younger people, their grandparents or whatever. We're talking, well, when they were very young then. Sorry. Okay, let's just say it. 20s, 30s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thousands and thousands of people. You have these pictures. I actually use them sometimes because they're so horrific. They really kind of kick you in the face. And especially, I mean, I feel their pain, but sooner or later, they're in college now. They need to know.
Right.
These pictures of people in their nice Sunday dresses, the kids, the picnic basket, taking a selfie,
pre-selfie.
With the tortured, bleeding, beaten to death, and then hung. If it's a woman, surely gang-raped before too.
Yep.
You know? Talk about Holocaust. And remember last time we said we shouldn't do it? And that's all the better reason for me to defy my own maxim and do it, right?
Yep.
But the competitive who suffered more, you know, the Jewish Holocaust was a pretty nasty Holocaust, no doubt about that. And I can speak about it relatively comfortably because, you know, half my family was gassed. But, you know, there were other horrors. Other people suffered. Like there were 28 million Russians. The Germans, people forget what happened to them. They weren't directly involved, the vast majority of them. I mean, should they have made sure? Should they have gone into the underground? Maybe. I hope that had I been, you know, an Aryan German in the 30s, I would join the partisans, you know, or hide Jews and gay people gypsies, you know.
And there was quite a few of them.
I should hope so, and some did. But what we don't talk about, the horror of what happened to Germany when the Red Army kind of came in. I mean, like, they were encouraged to brutally rape, for example. So consider that the generation of the grandmothers...
the very, very old by now, mostly dead. But if you go back 20 years, you know, all these nice old German women, you can count them out. Right? One raped. One raped. One raped, because mm-hmm. about half of them were.
Right.
At all ages. So the trauma there too. Right, so it's something that often is forgotten is the victimhood of the perpetrators. You know, that those who are sent to do it, whether it's kids in Vietnam under Pol Pot sent to, you know, run the camps and do executions at the age of 14 or earlier maybe. I mean, they are damaged for life. I mean, many of them kill themselves, beat their families, don't function, or what have you, right? Alcoholic, died already a while ago. Things like that. So I mean, I'm not willing. I think we should look at the suffering of the Germans. You know, we were asking for it as a nation. Yeah. As an individual?
No.
Case by case, right? Mm-hmm. Case by case. So there's that, you know, the victimhood and here I'm violating my maxim. We should all be solidarity together and stop competing on who suffered more. But by God, black people in America. You know, they probably, if we do make that competition, the only ones who might be giving them some competition would be women as a whole, I think. That would be the only demographic. Sorry, Irish, you know, you mm-hmm. suffered for longer than anybody on the planet, I think. Because we forget that the Irish started to be occupied and molested by the English in the
right.
Middle Ages. And so there are over 700 years, and still today. I mean, still my generation, even, you know, when I was a kid, there was this kind of white, when I was a kid, it was probably like it was in rural South in America, to be Irish or to be black. It's like, yeah, you were looked really down upon.
Even in the big cities.
And mentioned, it was like the riffraff, you know, it was like the rednecks, if you will. And mm-hmm. as you know, I like to point out to people that we can't say the N-word and we shouldn't.
But we
have a special license, but we can say redneck and white trash and hillbilly. And those are, well, that's the great tragedy. That's why whenever maybe we're beginning to get over racism, as the young people seem to significantly finally, hallelujah, thank you, young people. Somebody will come to fan the flames because it's so damn useful. Imagine what the politics would be. If all the poor or, you know, poor, what exactly how we want to define it, right? That's another thing we get confused about. Like, let's say anybody at the bottom 50%, not just the poor, anybody who's, you know, making less than 30 grand a year, or 40 grand a year-ish, that puts you in the bottom 50%, easy. They got together. So the rural whites, and I can say it, but I say it in a, you know, I have in my office books, like, you know, the Redneck Manifesto, you know, and that's a friend of mine who educated me about that precisely. He was an odd guy, a true Southern cracker. That's how he called himself. But at the same time, a radical, very radical left wing. I mean, baby, like he's flaming commie, you know, some of my best friends. I like a diverse group of friends, by the way. Otherwise, I get bored too easy.
Right.
I like to have a good, healthy argument. If I disagree with my friends, all the better for it. We have a good time arguing, and both our positions are improved through that argument. You know, I think that's the thing. It's not that I'm trying to convert, but with that exchange, we're improving the quality of both of our beliefs. Maybe we do change our minds. Sometimes people change their minds. It's perfectly normal.
But I'm definitely with you on this get over it thing. I've heard it. I've heard it among friends. And of course, you know,
before, I get into slapping mode, except in class.
Before President Obama got elected, I mean, among my friends, you know, and they were, you know, at 50%, you know, not making the 30,000, you know, white mm-hmm. and the whole bit. And, they were going like, well, America's not ready for a black president. I'm going like, well, you know, when? You know, or does it even matter?
What does it mean?
Yeah, exactly. What does it mean? But these very same, people, and, you know, and I'm not just talking about, the very few friends of mine that do say that, but, in the airline field, which is predominantly dominated by, military people, mostly on the pilot side. Yeah.
On the pilot side. Yeah. Because they already know they're, they already have the skills. Right?
They, would say stuff like that. You know, get over it. It's like we're all one nation now and everything's cool. You know, we all have big one big happy family.
Yeah.
But then they would turn around and say something to a female flight attendant that was completely sexist, you know, and horrific. Or they would totally ignore the male flight attendants because they had this perception that all male flight attendants were gay. And forget being Latino. I was perceived to be gay, minority, and shut up because, you know, we're giving you a break, you being here. Mm. And I have people actually tell me that. And you know, and I'm going like, okay, what century are you living in? And what planet? And if, is there a country there? Because I just don't believe the stuff that you're saying. A person that is in charge of 300 and something people in the air will say something like that. I mean, okay, it's got skill. But at the same time, it's kind of like, well, what if he decides that he wants to?
Let's settle down with that too, you know? I'm reminded of somebody actually, that's going to have to be another show probably, but somebody recently made disparaging remark about a certain gentleman who is the elected president of a certain country because he, alluding to the state of affairs in the country, is not good because he's just a brown-skinned bus driver originally. So I wanted to say that, you know, pilots, it's a bus driver too. In fact, probably the skills are more important. You know, we entrust our lives of our children to the streets and school buses. You know, I mean, I'm more worried about the quality skills of that person.
But I saw that a lot, and the demographic was over middle age, white.
Sure.
You know, and you know, as far as economics, we all know they make a good substantial amount of money. I mean, the ones now are barely cutting it.
But now they have all these like ridiculous. Does this whole thing now? You have like pilots on like pretty literally poor, making barely more, right?
Oh yeah. Well, the average salary for a pilot starting off, and I had a friend of mine who became a pilot. He used to work for UPS, you know, from one bus to another, right?
Yeah.
He started off at 20,000, and I know, having been in the field, flight attendant salary a year starts off at 16,000.
Yeah, that's what I heard. That pilots now, it used to be, I know, we always, in the days, pilots were like, you know, I mean, they weren't rich, but they were really kind of well off.
Right.
But now it's like, yeah, that's like well under the median pay.
Actually, well, I would compare the pilot profile to the pilot on Family Man.
No.
I mean, pretty much verbatim. It's just like that. It's sexist. I mean, saying all the wrong things and all that. But
well, some professions have also that kind of allure, right? I mean, that's kind of this machoistic thing at the boys club. And again, to be honest, don't we all, anybody who's been a boy at some point in their lives, probably remembers how boys can get all like, you know, excitable and in a crowd. They become, I think it's the sci-fi author that used to write these tiny short stories, not short stories, like micro stories, sometimes one paragraph. Back in the 70s, Frederick Brown, no. I might be confusing. I think he was called Frederick Brown. I might be confused. I need to. Well, anyway, he had this saying in a very short story. I remember it. Take it for a grain of salt. Maybe it's something completely different. But anyway, that if you want to get the intelligence of a crowd, like of a group of people, you're gonna take the average intelligence of the group and divide it by the number of people. So basically, a mob of people has the intelligence of a slug.
That makes sense, though.
It does, doesn't it?
That makes sense.
So you get all into that group thing and this reinforcing, and somebody cracks the joke and everybody, and you know, boys, especially of a certain age, can do that.
Right.
You have to really take a deep breath.
But that's all pretty much immaturity.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you would think that
once. But it preserves, like in the army, in a bunch of pilots, you know, they're a bunch of guys together. There's that bunch of guys together thing that usually doesn't.
My mom, as a nurse, used to tell me these stories about doctors. They're pretty much the same. It's almost like an A-type personality, you know, which in psychological terms do help, you know, with their skills because you have to be very decisive on your decisions, you know. But then at the same time, that doesn't really work for society.
Sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, like doctors, they famously say, this is why we do this, because we need to detach ourselves from the, you know, otherwise we'll go crazy. But, you know, there's a lot of problems, like, of course, as women go increasingly into the profession like doctoring, it's a hostile environment for them. You know, so what, get over it? That means that if a woman wants to be a doctor, she needs to behave like a male jerk of the worst kind in order to fit in. I mean, some women know exactly what I'm talking about, because sometimes that's indeed all you can do, is basically become worse than the guys.
Right, worse than the guys.
In order to survive the environment as a woman. But of course, the cost to you as a woman to behave like that, yet still maintain at least the possibility of becoming a mother, let's say, or as is the case in the economy, that the vast majority of all the care given, especially non-pay, right? So taking care of old parents, of kids, of households, of friends. It's the women who do it.
Right, right.
After they're done, they're competing, being jerks with their colleagues at work. So there's a lot of costs and difficulties for women to integrate into a field that is dominated by this kind of, male bonding group.
And it doesn't help them either on their issues either, because the people that they need to convince are usually Neanderthals, men. They interpret those actions as like, okay, well, this is what we need to stop, because otherwise we're going to be, overtaken by women and all that kind of stuff. And, we all know that's not true.
Women should get over the fact that they ensure the survival of the race. Imagine if we were only guys. Pretty sad world, and also pretty short-term one.
Yeah. Very
but
boring.
Hey, I think I mentioned, I read somewhere in this, not Gizmodo level here, and nothing against Gizmodo, Gizmodo is great, but I mean, serious story about, I think Scientific American a couple of years ago, where they're really playing in some labs in Britain, I think they're playing with successfully with combining two, female zygotes, right?
Oh God, right.
Embarrassed people. And my horrible biology. Yeah, so basically you can create a test tube baby, if you will, without sperm. Just two women. So men are kind of obsolete, in other words, if that becomes a thing. So my joke about that typically is to tell the boys to start being nice.
Yeah, exactly. And they should be nice.
You don't want to be treated like drones, but even the bees need the drones, so they use them up for sex and then kill them, right? So. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that's not the best outcome. Jokes aside. But yeah, get over it. I mean, come on. But this is an example, though, asking women to get over it. Oh, feminism is passé. And this is actually what's going on right now, right? It's shocking to think. It's like, oh, yeah, feminism is like, it's almost a dirty word. I think it's coming back to, as part of this I'm very optimistic about this whole resurgence from the youth. And, young people are... I'm hoping opening their minds and their minds are open, but maybe taking action too. So that's wonderful. That's a few things that give me hope. So that's great. But still there's a stigma with feminism. How could there be a stigma with somebody asking to be treated decently, equally, to be given equal opportunity? What do you want black people to get over? The fact that, that we've been living off their labor and up till today in a large sense. That's the thing. And there's not getting over it is of course very insensitive and really, not disrespectful, insulting, it's literally a deep insult. All right. And hence was my comment about should we tell Jews to get over the Holocaust? I don't think that would be popular. You'd be called an anti-Semite. I don't know exactly if anti-Semitism is the right thing to be called for saying that, but certainly you should be called out for saying it, because, how would you get over it? It's not over. It's here, or it's in my head. Jews have achieved a lot of success in the world in recent times, frankly. People, you go on the internet, you find a lot of, YouTube things that are like, both historically inaccurate as well as kind of uncomfortable, I think. I'm open to criticism. Like, for example, I criticize policies of the State of Israel pretty vocally and
pretty
openly.
Often.
And
yeah.
Often. Mm-hmm. But that's something, that's a criticism I'm making, I'm not making, it's not because the Jews control the world. It's a very different argument, because they don't. We don't. I wish maybe we do it could have been nice, but no. Or the media. So you have this bargaining, like, you know, new anti-Semitism among actually political activists on YouTube. A lot of what they're saying maybe is correct, but that bit is not. This notion that Jews has always had power and money is literally a little bit, I know Rothschild, I know. And yeah, the stories of how he speculated and played both sides, the father to start the family fortune is simply false, by the way. This whole notion that he started a war in order to speculate is just utterly false. And a lot of people, simply because you hear it one place doesn't mean it's true.
Right.
Not that there aren't, today in America, I am constantly and daily reminded of the embarrassment that, we are well represented among the banksters. Certainly more than our numbers in the population. Sort of like black people in jail. No, not anywhere near as overrepresented.
Right, right.
But certainly not the couple of percentage points that we are in the population. In Wall Street, we're more.
But that's the perception that's been fed to the general population.
No, but that's true, actually. There are kind of quite a lot of Jews in Wall Street, and currently Wall Street is not in a good, has behaved in very inappropriate ways, for several decades now. And frankly, they responded to incentives, including that given by the Fed, Chairman Alan Greenspan, the president, the deregulating maniacs such as primarily Bill Clinton and then George W. Bush. So, yeah, and Barack Obama keeps steering the ship, you know, hasn't even nudged the steering wheel, basically business as usual. So
put it on cruise control.
Yeah, they're in power, you know, they are in power, they call the shots. But I have to deal with that. It's a fact. It's a painful fact. I'd like to say no, 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 no. And when no, no, no is appropriate, do the Jews control the media in America, like some people claim? No. No, they don't. Is the Jewish lobby, specifically AIPAC, behaving in unscrupulous and disgusting ways? Absolutely. You know? I'm comfortable with being ethnically a Jew. I'm comfortable with coming from Israel as my country of origin, though I wasn't, well, close. But I can criticize it nonetheless. Right? I mean, it's kind of this, I don't have to buy it. Everything, the whole package.
Right, right, yeah? Right.
But we are expected to do that all the time. It's actually really, you don't fit if you don't buy a package.
Buy the whole thing. Mm-hmm.
Right? You have to, amen, 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 you know, to all the articles of faith. If you, I believe in 8 out of 10, we agree on a lot. Oh, no, you're not pure. How can you say that? This is all part of that apparatus, and I think it's overwhelmingly linguistic, actually. It's rhetoric. The one I keep mentioning from that kind of blew my mind, the appendix, rereading, George Orwell's 1984, and the book is okay. It's historically important. It's not great. And anyway, Animal Farm is a better book by far. I think I like it better, but the appendix on language in 1984 is precisely, some people will remember these issues like calling the Ministry of Peace for the war. I mean, but that's almost common, not even weird, yes. And he was really kind of a little bit making, I mean, not a little bit, he was one of the first intellectuals to kind of realize that Stalin destroyed whatever good there was in the Soviet revolution of the 1917. And frankly, there was a lot of good, because before it was awful, right? People forget that, right? I mean, did they do a lot of bad things? Well, initially, maybe not so much, but certainly by the time Stalin, after World War II, given a few more years, yeah, it started getting off. Not just bad. I mean, like, criminal. Crime against humanity. Horror, horror, horror. People were in denial. Most, intellectuals of the time, certainly, not even intellectuals, you know, were very lefty. In America, too. So they were all Soviet Union, you know, we should stay their friends at the very least, we should learn from them, etc. And he was one of the first people to say, wait a minute, something's wrong. And it took a while. I mean, first everybody was, you know, he was shunned almost as a traitor in a sense, right? But anyway, the appendix on language, where he talks about this kind of, you know, this double speak of the regime and their propaganda, in that, dystopic world of 1984, in the appendix, he kind of outlines what he was really trying to get at, but basically couldn't do, is the language in which you cannot think critically. You can only repeat slogans. You can only reassure commitment. You can only, you know, yell articles of faith.
Yep. Listen up, Marco Rubio.
So we're here, you know, we're here.
Marco Rubio is being accused of that, of repeating the slogans, doing his campaign like a robot. But they all do.
Yeah.
They all do.
Different slogans that don't really determine the policy that then they will enact. Because they're not accountable to the public or to voters. They're accountable to funders. Maybe executed more effectively. So maybe Ted Cruz is a bit stumbling. Maybe he's too stupid. Unlike Trump, who may seem like, oh my God, did you hear what Trump says? But don't you realize that what he says is just exactly what he needs to say to
right.
do well?
It's calculative, yeah. Yeah.
He's feeding off the fears, anxieties, the insecurities, and giving the slant.
And the thing is, I mean, during the debate this weekend, and commentators and all that, one thing that everybody agreed on is that Trump is not doing anything different than what everybody else in that particular party and even in the Democratic Party are actually thinking. The nasty stuff. People think that. You know, in that party, when it comes to immigration, you know, all that kind of stuff, it's the only difference here is that Trump is actually vocalizing it.
Right.
You know, I mean, so do we say, well, okay, Trump should be shot for it and not the people who are thinking about it? I mean,
that's all symbolic.
I have to go back to my old Catholic ways. It's kind of like if you're thinking about this sinning, you've already sinned.
Yeah,
at least that's what this preacher used to.
It's like Frank Baum, Wizard of Oz, right? Who was this flaming liberal, or more so, back in the times when America did its great transformation from an underdeveloped rural slave economy to the industrial, high-skill, high-tech powerhouse that came to rule the world in the 1870s. It's a whole era, right? Maybe more a decade, but that's the populist era. Actually, the Wizard of Oz is full with economic symbolism. It's very much so. He was a very progressive guy, pushed by his wife to be even more progressive. And, you know, it's an interesting story. That's the previous period of populism, of the proverbial 99% sick and tired of this. And there were also differences in urban centers. It was very kind of traditional European with all the immigrants. This immigrants back then were coming from Europe, right? So it was more traditional socialist. This is pre-Russian Revolution socialist people. Yeah, I'm talking just shortly. A couple of decades following the Civil War. And in the rural, in the breadbasket, it was different. It was much more traditional, Christian, you know, of course, but it was also populist. So there's a degree of parallels a little bit here in this period. If the outcome is any close to what it was then, we're good. Because one of the outcomes that came out then in the early 20th century, to go back to your original comment very early in the show about why were they just better politicians back then? Not perfect, but better. Or in some sense, at least. I'm thinking that maybe one of the main reasons, at least, there were the people. First of all, the people did have a matter. And even if the votes not so much, clearly, they were marching. They were organizing. There were like a significant proportion of the American population ready to rise. You know, people forget that in the FDR, there was 30% of Americans were red socialists, not traitors to America.
Right,
not
right.
Pro Russia or anything. But they believed in, you know, the New Deal was the least of what they would want. The least of it.
And I'm not saying that they were necessarily absolutely right, by the way, but that pressure led to, hey, you know, America did pretty well since FDR.
Right.
Yes. Where did we get all that science, all that technology, all those engineers, you know, all those roads, all the electric grid, all of the stuff we love, we like and cherish and are proud of today kind of came out of. Maybe it's time to repeat something that bears repeating, that at least in the low 90% of all what we call high tech today is government funded and literally created, by the way. So your smartphone, it's like 96%, roughly. Kind of a rough number, but not an outlandish one. Kind of the average number for current, you know, digital technology would be over 95% of it is value added by public enterprise. If you measure it properly, I'm not just talking about the roads on which the brown truck brought it in the attractive, cool box to your house. Who built that road? Do you think Amazon could do as well as it does today if we didn't have road system? Yeah. How about when did you order it? On what? Internet. Yeah. 100%. Right.
Mm-hmm. Military.
Transistor radios. Right. First it was vacuum tubes. The very technology of digital computing. You know, before even there were computers, they did it by hand to crack codes in World War II. Famously with Alan Turing, who was finally brought out of oblivion as one of the most important people in the 20th century. Made to kill himself because he was gay by the draconian British laws of the time and disgusting behavior of the first degree. Considering you just got, you know, your greatest, maybe one of the five greatest people in the, from the British side, certainly in the World War II effort. And one of the greatest minds of your people's history, you know? And what did you do to it? You know, horrific. Things like that. Anyway, yeah? So there was a base of population. Hence, another reason why I'm happy to hear that, you know, middle schoolers are really progressive in America, right? Because maybe they will form that kind of pressure group that will force politicians to pay attention or elites to realize that, okay, you know what? Maybe we've bitten a bit too much. Let's compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Because after all, okay, raise my taxes by a few percentage points. It, frankly, it's not really hurting me at all on the margin, right? I don't like to pay more taxes. Who does? But it's not like changing my consumption habits how many generations, you know. And I'm talking about taxing not the little rich like the Europeans are doing so effectively. Oh, let's get the person who has $1 million, who worked all his life and managed to accumulate $1 million. I mean, that's very nice to manage to accumulate $1 million.
Right.
I know I think it's too late for me. Surely. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm good. But it's certainly not the deep wealth. All right. So they get away with typically paying nothing.
Right.
And we're talking trillions again. Yeah. Having said that, right? So could we get to a point where somebody will say, okay, let's compromise. All right. I'll pay a little bit more. If nothing else, just to shut the riffraff down to make them happy for a while because they're getting antsy and angry and they're unemployed and we cut their welfare and there's no opportunity to get a job or to advance in life. In fact, most of them are slipping back every year. So they're beginning to get to the point where they have nothing to lose. And elites are never stupid by definition a little bit. At the very least, they get, you know, good education, typically, you know.
It's almost like, well, I shouldn't say history repeats itself because it does once in a while, but it's you draw a distinct parallel here because great deal from FDR, you know, back then had a lot of opposition. Now, could you imagine now, I mean, and of course, I'm sure people, politicians have proposed something similar, but they have gotten shot down in today's, you know, politics. And, you know, I firmly believe that's what's needed right now. It is at least the perception, you know, that alone would at least move some things, but it's not going to happen.
Dude, you know, I mean, the whole notion that, I mean, it's like some kind of radical thought to say that the core problem of the American economy is that the bulk of the people are too poor. Giving more money to millionaires does not have a positive impact on the American economy. They do not create jobs. It doesn't work like that. Now, depends on circumstance. Sometimes they do. But right now, they don't. Because they're not good opportunities. Or when they do, they create bad jobs. What is lacking chronically in the American economy, the reason why we're still on life support since 2008, we're going to enter the next crisis on life support, so God knows what state we'll be in, is that the bulk, the middle class, is their economy is eroded. Our economy eroded. I do not spend like I used to, you know, anymore, because I am just correctly concerned with the future. I know that, like, the proverbial, I don't know, 90%, let's say, to use a reasonably accurate number when I'm pulling it, like, out of my head real quick, are not seeing improvements. In fact, they're seeing decline, right? So we're worried and we cut down our consumption, for a rainy day, for fear, whatever. The bottom 90% has also for decades now and accelerated in an accelerating rate in the past few years since the crisis, have experienced a reduction in our wages, very significantly so, right? With very few exceptions, if any. Our salaries still go up depending on where we are and the circumstance exactly, of course, and if we are unionized or not and how good the union is and things like that. Our salaries are nominal salaries. The number, right, goes up slowly, but nowhere near enough to keep up with the cost of living. That has been going on for decades. The increasingly so leads to a palpable, I am poorer than I used to be a couple of years ago. And the majority of Americans correctly see the same thing. And that is the chronic problem. Now, the joke is that this is like ABC principles of macroeconomics. The arguments between the Austrians and the Keynesians and the post-Keynesians and the neoclassical, they happen elsewhere. Maybe relative importance. Maybe in Austria, and this is kind of the economists that are behind, if you will, or the libertarian kind of approach, right? They might propose ways in which you can improve markets with minimal government intervention, but they still know that we have a problem of aggregate demand. The argument could be then, how do we get money in the hands of the masses, right? Because the rich person gets an extra dollar, right? Or let's use happier numbers. The rich person gets $1,000, right? That $1,000... as a marginal, a real rich, okay? Somebody who has tens of millions of dollars. So it puts you in the 0.0001%. It's not 1%. To be in 1%, you have to only have about an income of, half a million? Roughly, depending on state, depending on so many things. So please take these numbers with a huge grain of salt, but roughly. I'm just trying to communicate that this is not a multimillionaire to be in the 1%, yeah? There's a little rich. The little rich.
A little. Just
the little rich. Or like, you know, talking about, we'll raise income tax, but Obama likes the number of $250,000. Now, I'd love to make $250,000. Hell, I'd love to have a combined income of me, my wife, and most of our friends together to make that.
I'd be just happy with making 50
exactly,
at that point.
Right? But that's not filthy rich. That's upper middle class.
Right.
You know, very upper middle class. True. And I know a lot of people, especially rich people, don't realize how rich they are. That's, again, a fact.
You're right about that.
Much more rich. They have no idea just how families are living, you know, with a fraction, with what they pay their gardener. You know, all four of us.
No, you're right.
Like that.
You're right. You're right about that. A lot of rich people do not know how rich they are.
Right. And sometimes they're shocked. I even see it here. We have a lot of rich students. And sometimes after they study a little economics, and it doesn't necessarily change their at all. Often, usually, I don't try, and I certainly don't succeed then. I don't see myself changing the political minds of anybody. And I have a lot of students, and I always teach very contested stuff, always political, all the way, whatever the topic is. So I add a little bit extra technicalities, perhaps, if it's a econ class. But otherwise, I talk like I talk right here, you know? Pretty much.
What do you think is the percentage of... people who might change their mind or
Well, again, what is changing your mind? I'm not looking for an ideological change of mind. I really am not, you know? And I'm happy to say that I don't really see any of my students ever changing their mind. I mean, changing their ideology. They might, they improve their thoughts, mm-hmm. I should hope. I mean, that's my job description.
Or they evolve, which is the word nowadays.
Yes, but I'm not talking evolving into a particular position. I really am not. But I'd like, you know, if you're a young, like, right winger, I don't know, most young, you know, a Republican, a conservative, whatever we want to call it, fine. Well, let's look at your, what does it mean? You know, what are your assumptions? What are your goals? I mean, you find actually when you start breaking this stuff down, you find that really what I keep saying, once you realize the reality and appreciate that you might interpret reality differently and some things strike us stronger than others, etc. So there's no such thing as just brute fact in the world. We're past that. We passed it like in the 1950s, ish. But still there's things a lot of things we can agree upon, you know, then the argument becomes on exactly how and costs and benefits. And that's a productive argument, but we're not denying the fact that it's as close as, you know, as a fact that the reason why the economy is kind of spluttering, why don't we see a recovery or barely any mild at best and not really recovery since the crisis of late 2007, early 2008. Well, because we didn't change. We keep on doing the same things.
I know.
Yeah. What do you expect will happen? We funded the system, selling our futures, in exchange for a little cash now. And, we didn't change the way we do things, and therefore, what do you expect will happen, soon enough? But you know what? Here, I can do another rare thing. Let me say something good about the president. Again, not personally, I don't care, don't know. He actually, at some point early on, I remember quite distinctly, when the first muttering started, why are you compromising so much? Why aren't you... You have a mandate. You have a massive, mm-hmm. massive majority. We haven't seen one like that in a long time, even without counting the several million votes that were, you know, Democratic votes. Well, most of them, because they were targeting blacks and,
right.
you know,
mm-hmm.
to disenfranchise them with technicalities and whatever. So come on, you know, why we voted you in to do this. Why aren't you doing it? He answered along the lines of make me. You have to make me do it. And, you know, that's stupid. I've never called him, by the way, and I never will. Maybe disillusioned moderate or something. You know, moderate that doesn't get it. He's not alone. Sometimes, some difficult times call for difficult measures.
Mm-hmm.
And being compromising like that. And his true beliefs being a kind of a conservative, you know. Middle centrist conservative, but certainly no radical or socialist or anything. The only thing about that is that it became an extremely effective way to shut up the dissent and this kind of pressure, right? Because even black people calling him out for not doing things
mm-hmm.
are being attacked. You know, people like Cornel West. I mean, you know, come on, cut some credit here. You know, he's fool he isn't. Whatever you think about him, I'm bit of a fan, as you know.
Yeah, I'm a fan too.
So they were criticizing him, and I like to. So that was a very effective cynical method. That it was difficult to criticize him from the left, in other words, from the American perspective, for what so many Americans voted him into office for to do, what he said he would do. Right? That's kind of why people voted for him, perhaps. And he didn't. He couldn't. They wouldn't let him. Fine. He compromised too readily, too early. He thought that, you know, compromise kind of, he's a centrist, you know, reasonable, not a crazy, you know, off the cuff guy like me. He's a responsible, reasonable guy, serious guy. So, and that doesn't work.
Yeah. No, you're right. It does not work.
But remember, make me. So basically was he saying like, hey, you, all you guys, anti-war group, social justice group, all these anti-Bush groups, don't go home. Stay in the streets.
Right.
When I start suggesting to, humanely bomb one country or another,
No, what, humanitarian intervention.
Sure.
One of the ugliest, talking about Orwellian
language.
I hate
when they say that.
Orwellian language. This is like, yeah, Orwell couldn't come up with that stuff. If he'd come up with it, people wouldn't buy his book because they think it's just silly. Nobody's going to be like that. I mean, ever. Yeah. That's cynical. At any rate, if they would have been in the streets, maybe Obama administration would have been much better. I'm not even, I'm smiling. I'm okay with it. But the whole notion of Obama's problem or whatever is too left wing. That's just nonsense. I'm
right.
willing to say
right.
that.
Yeah, no, it
I'm
is
open-minded,
nonsense.
But sometimes I'm willing to say that is just nonsense.
It is nonsense, and I know, on my personal opinion, and you know, perspective, a lot of my friends is, you know, he's done very minimal changes, and most of us feel like we were let down.
Sure.
Because we were expecting, you know, radicalism. I mean, I'm a little bit more of a time tame than what I used to be, but I was expecting. Some real changes.
Yeah.
Anyway, top of the hour, Punkonomics, live from the WPRK.
Yeah, so that we finished the motif by saying that, you know, it doesn't matter that much who's in office. It matters Litters. That the people insist on having a say.
Yep.
That's what matters. Right wing, left wing, also doesn't matter.
And actually, that's the only thing that matters. Mm. Yeah.
People have
doing
to,
it
no,
themselves.
No.
So, Punkonomics webpage or .org, punkonomics.org, Facebook and all that, and of course
we have technical difficulties. I'll get into them. Yeah, we're not feeding the podcasts anymore for some reason for a couple of weeks now. So if anybody subscribed to our podcast and wondering where the hell the past like 4 or 5 are, I'll get to it as soon as I possibly can.
All right, folks. Sorry. Well, coming up next, Front Porch Radio with and Julie Norris and
I see Smith back there.
Somebody's going like, oh.
The one, the only Smith Sanders is in studio number one, shaking his head at us and telling us that Julie is not on the air. Sorry.
And probably saying, get off the mic already.
Yeah, he looks antsy a little bit there.
All right. adios, muchachos. See you next week.
Yep.
Muchachos and muchachas.
Yep.
Do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.